It's Tim and Tom with Tim Bradstreet and some guy you've never heard of. Until now.
And here we are with podcast number 3 of the increasingly unnamed Tim Bradstreet Tom Racine podcast. We are in the midst of a contest trying to find out the name. We still have not made a decision at this point, but soon.
No clear winner has been chosen.
No clear winner, but there will be a piece of original artwork from Tim Bradstreet. So make sure you get out there to the Raw forums and give us a good name, because you will get something cool out of it. This is going to be a show about movie composers and music, one of Tim Bradstreet's very, very favorite subjects, so we're going to get into that. The man is deep well of knowledge of movie composers.
I love that.
You are like the, you know.
Wait, back it up. Say that again, and I'll try not to laugh when you say that.
Tim is a deep well of knowledge of music composers and film scores. He didn't laugh. Well, I'm very impressed. So we will be talking about music and film and the importance of therein. And basically, let's just jump into the biggest question. Why do you like movie scores so much?
Wow, we're jumping right into it.
Jumping right in, baby.
Wow, you...
We don't screw around here.
You do not mess around, Tom. Well, the thing is... God, that just... it's such a cold jump in. Hey, I like this movie, man. This movie was really good. Oh, well, did you know that the score was by, you know? That's kind of where I normally start talking about it. Is, you know, we'll go to a movie and be like, like I actually go to movies to go, I know who's doing the score and I'm a fan or whatever. Like, sometimes I'll go to a movie just to hear the score.
Yeah.
That's kind of that.
Well, we'll jump it back
in the context of the film, because generally you can buy a score week before the movie comes out. But
yeah, or hear it on the internet.
You get those spoilers, like those track titles, like Qui-Gon's death. Oh, wait a minute. I bought... Episode 1 soundtrack and Qui-Gon dies. Okay. Ooh, sorry, I spoiled that for anyone that hasn't seen Episode 1 yet.
Was that? I don't remember those movies. We'll jump it back. How did you get started? I mean, when you were obviously you're a huge movie fan.
That's actually a good lead in because to my knowledge, and I think a lot of people can say this, it was Star Wars that made me a score fan. Yeah, it was John Williams' Star Wars score. I mean, that's really weird, but that's
probably where it started for people our age, especially.
Yeah, you know, it was that theme song. You know, I'm not going to try to hum it or anything, but no, wait, that's Indiana Jones. I wanted to be Luke. It's like when I saw Star Wars, everyone wanted to be Han. I wanted to be Luke. Because I wanted to be that guy who came from the farm, who was nothing, who got this opportunity. Anyway, the music was so, I don't know, it just pulled on my heart, you know?
Well, that's the scene, I think, that makes it when he's looking at the two sons and the theme raises up, and it's really beautiful. It is a wonderful moment. I think that's the first time, I mean, aside from the opening sequence, but that, when I was a kid, when I saw him look at those sons.
Classic opening sequence.
The sequence, yes.
Well, yeah.
You just couldn't let that slide, because you had to jump in.
That's okay. It just does. I mean, it hits you like a hammer.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful moment. He's looking at the sunset, and the music is uplifting. It's beautiful. By the way, I always wanted to be Uncle Owen. I don't know why. So
wanted to be a husk, a steaming husk out in front of
better than wanting to be Aunt Beru.
I remember the Star Wars card I had with that. I actually remember the caption on the Star Wars card where no, it's not that card, but it's the card that comes directly after it. Like, one card is the burnt skeletons laying there, the torched skeletons, whatever they are. And then the next card is this great shot of Mark Hamill, like with this look on his face, like someone just, you know, kicked him in the stomach.
Right. Because he just saw Uncle
Owen's
skeleton.
And it says, the caption is, "A horrified Luke sees his family killed."
And now you never forgot that. Isn't that great how certain things stick in you like that? I love that.
That was my favorite Star Wars card.
I would like to say that I probably go back a little bit further. My parents were older. I mean, my dad was 45 and my mom was 45 when they had me. And I grew up watching a lot of old movies. And I'm a huge fan of, like, The Adventures of Robin Hood. It's probably my favorite movie, the 1939 Errol Flynn version. And the Eric Korngold score. I mean, all of those great, the Seahawk.
That's a classic score, man.
All of those amazing Errol Flynn action films. And it was mostly Korngold, but it was a lot of those other just the guys under contract, but they were like great composers from Europe.
And, right.
I love them.
Well, that's where they all came over because of the war.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Korngold came. I mean, wasn't he a German?
Yeah.
Michael Curtiz, the director.
Yeah. Michael Curtiz, the director, was, I don't know if he was German, but he was definitely.
I guess his name was Korngold. You would be a German Jew. Yes. So
likely,
got the hell out, is what happened.
Pretty much.
And he came here. And that's, you know, a lot of Max Steiner, I think, was a war transplant.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of them. A lot of people came to Hollywood from the war because it was weird. You know, they kind of worked with Hollywood in a sense because actually Germany had a really good film kind of thing going on.
Well, they were the best. Yeah, in the silent era, all the silent stuff, the cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah,
all that stuff.
Exactly. And when the war started, they had a place to go, you know. I mean, they could actually come here, get work, and it wasn't like they had to starve, you know. Yeah. I mean, it was getting out was tough. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not saying it was a cakewalk, but you know, that's a lot
especially
of
carrying that whole orchestra. That's really hard.
It's so difficult to carry everybody.
You thought the Von Trapps had it hard, boy. I tell you, you got the whole string section behind you. That ain't easy.
Tom, I am giving you full marks for that one. That was genius, brother. You know, here's the thing. I've since I got into scores, I've ended up learning a lot from guys who are older than me that are into scores. And one of those guys is Ed Dennis. He used to run a great shop called Pop Culture in Dallas. Mm. And he used to go around to conventions selling very hard to find rare scores and bootlegs and stuff like that. And now he works for Screen Archives, which is really cool. I mean, I've got a guy on the inside works for Screen Archives, buddy. But it's Screen Archives and Film Score Monthly kind of banded together. It's kind of like the same thing now. And so my buddy Ed Dennis, you know, he turned me on to a lot of stuff, and he kind of opened my eyes to a lot of things. And also a guy who is active on this website called, I haven't been on it in a long time, it's a Film Score website, but I can't. I'll come back to that. We will come back to that. I've got it saved as a favorite. I'll just go check it later. But this cat I met at a camera shop. There's this really awesome like camera shop downtown San Diego, and Nelson Photo. And one of the cats that works there, we got talking about scores one time, and I found out this guy knows his stuff, and he's big time collection. And I've learned, and that's where I kind of discovered Korngold. It wasn't in Max Steiner, the King Kong score.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never was into that stuff. I was kind of one of those, for a long time, I was one of those snobby, I only like James Horner and John Williams and Hans Zimmer, you know, kind of guys. Thankfully, someone opened my eyes, and now I'm a real snob.
There's more to it.
But I'm a snob in the way that, like, Jack Black and John Cusack are in High Fidelity, okay? Yeah. So I have, my taste is supreme, Jack. Oh, actually, to quote Jack Black, that's like something Jack Black would say.
That's right.
It's supreme.
Do not mess with Tim Bradstreet when it comes to film scores. And I mean, I do think it for people of our generation.
No, I'm no Tom. I don't want to escape with that coming out. I don't consider myself to be a seriously. You know, I know nothing compared to some people.
Well, I know, but
it's a passion of mine.
But you're comparing. I mean, it's sort of like my attitude always been like, okay, you're a really good pianist. Maybe you're not a concert pianist, but you're obviously better than your average person because most people don't even. I mean, it's one of those things that, like anything else in film, if it's really really good, it probably sits in the background and just makes the experience better. But then every now and then, of course, if you listen to it on its own, it's gorgeous, it's amazing stuff. I don't want it to jump out on its own. It's got to work with the imagery, obviously. And I think that's what's really amazing about the composers is that they can work with the imagery. And
well, the best ones are the ones where the music stands up without the film.
Yeah.
Without the context of the film, I should say.
Right.
And I mean, that's just common knowledge. I mean, that's not like some kind of epiphany for you folks, but but yeah, so you know, right now I'm really into a lot of the guys from the 60s. Really into a lot of the guys from the 60s, because like I said, for a long time, and I said Hans Zimmer a little while ago. I'm not a huge Hans Zimmer fan. I'm not like a lot of the crazy Hans Zimmer fans. I like some scores by Hans. I think he's fantastic when he's original, but he has the tendency to
repeat himself
copy from his own stuff. And of course, he's connected and I think ran the whole Media Ventures group, which were guys like Steve Yablonsky and Klaus Badelt and John Powell. A lot of guys who have since gone on to have great careers of their own. John Powell especially, really hitting a stroke. Well, Klaus Badelt too. Mm. But and Steve Yablonsky. Hey, wait a minute. I'm just repeating myself now. Yablonsky's kind of taken off. So I think he did the score for Transformers.
Are you Hans Zimmer? You're repeating yourself. What are you doing?
Did the score for... Hey, what's in theme with what I'm talking about?
It's brilliant. Jeff
Rona is another one of those guys. And these, you know, some of these names you probably never heard of, maybe all of them you never heard of, but that's why we're talking about it, because I kind of want to raise the consciousness of
damn
this
strange
a little bit.
That's what we do here. We raise consciousness.
Yeah, and we'll, and you know, if because I kind of would like to make this a regular segment, we'll end up getting into Media Ventures, and we'll get into talking about Hans Zimmer specifically at some point. But right now I want to talk about guys like Roy Budd. And guys like Lalo Schifrin, who it took me a long time to kind of get into it, because I was always in, and this is really directly because I got into scores because of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
I was into, you know, like space soundtracks and fantasy stuff and genre material, and Lalo Schifrin is way more of an urban, you know, kind of jazz kind of a guy. And but I think that's great, because if you're not able to access certain kinds of music based on your sensibilities, it takes something to kind of lead you there.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I'm kind of getting into jazz and stuff like that too, which I never gave two craps about. I really didn't. And of course, you sound like a moron when you say that, because anyone who knows anything about music, jazz is an art form. It should be respected and it should be embraced.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so sorry, kids. I'm slow to kind of get to this stuff, you know. And you know, this is a lifetime of tasting, is what it is.
Yeah.
And,
hey, you're opening your mind to new things.
That's right. And cool. I think it's important that everybody does. You know, I still haven't opened it to rap music.
Yeah.
Or top 40. But,
I like big butts, and I cannot lie.
Hey, don't mind the lyrics to some of them, but.
I'm just letting point out we're looking on about Lalo Schifrin, 193. Different films. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, the guy just worked all the time, and he's still working. He did Rush Hour 3, for God's sake.
Well, that's his newest one. I was talking to his son, Ryan, who I met at the San Diego Comic-Con this year. Actually, I didn't meet him there. I met him post-Comic-Con through friends, but I found out he was at the show, and I was like, nobody introduced me to this guy. And he went to my MySpace page, and I've got Shifting Gears cue from Bullet, which Lalo scored, playing on my MySpace page. And he sends me an email, and he's like, this is like synchronicity. He's like, you're a fan of my dad's. That's so cool. And I'm like, well, that's kind of why I... you know? And Ryan's a filmmaker, so that's really cool. But so hopefully, eventually, I'm going to get to meet this cat, but...
Yeah.
You know, Schifrin's such a big. I just love him. You know, it took me a while to kind of get to the point where, I mean, when I was a kid, I liked him, but I didn't know I liked him. You know,
yeah.
You're watching
yeah.
Dirty Harry, and you hear this score, and it plays in your head.
Or come on,
like
Mission
that.
Impossible is like the greatest
sure,
theme
sure.
of all time.
But I didn't, you know, when I was a kid, Lalo Schifrin.
Yeah, I know.
I knew Lalo Schifrin's name before I became a fan, because when you would watch stuff like Mission Impossible, you'd see his name
right,
in the credits
right.
every week, and yeah. you'd be like, Lalo Schifrin, that's a neat name. Yeah. Like, that's a weird name.
That's right. Lalo.
But,
isn't it one of the Teletubbies, Lalo?
But since I got into Lalo, I've since discovered that he, in fact, is one, you know, like, has scored some of my favorite films. And he's normally known for the urban score, like Dirty Harry, like Bullet.
Enter the Dragon.
Enter the Dragon.
That's
yeah.
a cool movie.
That's a great score, too, by the way.
Yeah.
Don Siegel directed that. And that's just
what I also love about him
good
is
all the way around.
He's all over the map. I mean, he did After the Sunset, and he did the Beverly Hillbillies movie. I mean, this is great. I mean,
I have to go back and watch After the Sunset, because I was just talking about it this weekend, because I was ragging on Brett Ratner. And I don't think I noticed this at the time, that he, and it's unlike me to not notice, but it somehow got under my radar, that he directed that film. And that's Pierce Brosnan, Woody Harrelson, Salma Hayek, Don
yeah.
Cheadle, right?
Right.
Yeah, I actually enjoyed that as a fun little romp.
Mm-hmm.
I'll
watch anything Salma Hayek does
yeah.
because
I don't think
I'm
I had any
her,
idea that so. Lalo Schifrin did the score until you just said that.
And
so
there you go.
Now it's
and he's, well, he's done all the Rush Hour 3, so he's done the Brett Ratner.
Well,
thing,
I've, so. I'm passionless about Rush Hour.
Yeah. me too.
And usually on the Brett Ratner subject.
Yes, in general. Yeah.
I don't hate the guy. And I said this on the board this week. I don't hate the guy. I hope he does. I hope to God. I hope he does a great film. And yeah. I hope that I can like eat my words. But I'm not really
not
that
hold
much
your
of
breath.
A fan.
Yeah.
But No, like I found out, well, I didn't find this out. I've known this for a long time, but Lalo scored one of my favorite scores, and it's a really eclectic and strange score, but it's also completely unlike anything he's ever done, and that's the score for THX-1138.
Oh, wow.
And it's just, God, it seems like I'm always listening to it, because it, you know, like some music that you listen to, that no matter how many times you listen to it, you still feel like you there's something you haven't heard before in it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like it's like, I think it was one of the Tool records, Anemia or Enema or whatever the hell you call it. Anema. I don't know how to pronounce it. Anema. I think I listened to that album 1,000 times before I started to get to the point where I was like, all right, that's getting a little, you know, that track, I don't know if I can listen to that anymore. But no, I mean, I just love it when I can continue to listening to a certain piece of music and it continues to affect me and it doesn't get old.
Yeah.
And THX is one of those. And another one of his scores, another different score from, it's not an urban score, is his score to the Hellstrom Chronicle, which I'm pretty sure, yeah, I got it off Screen Archive, so it's available there. But and also, that thank God for Screen Archives and Places Film Score Monthly, because they... You know, a lot of scores to your favorite movies are out of print, and these guys do special editions, and they know all the right people, so they get.
Can you download it online? Is that kind of, have they opened that yet?
I don't think they're that far.
I mean, how cool would that be? That'd be great.
That's probably in the next decade when a lot more people, you'll be able to just order. You'll buy everything digitally.
Yeah, but I mean, I just think they should start doing that. Offer on iTunes, I'd pay.
Well, they really should, because they could make a lot more money on it, because you know, like the CDs themselves are collectible because they do limited editions of like 3,000,
right?
You know, sometimes 1,500. You know, I've got this one of my first Film Score Monthly scores was the score to Omega Man by Ron Grainer, and it's, you know, it's like one of those very limited discs.
Chilton Heston.
Yeah, good stuff. You know, it's my childhood. I hated that score for the longest time. And I hate to mention Frank Darabont again, but Frank turned me around on this.
We got to have him on the show. He's like a presence on this show.
He's like, you're an idiot. You know, I'm like, I love Omega Man, but it's so dated. I'm like, if you just got, like, I don't know, Jerry Goldsmith to just do the score and then loop it, you know, like put it in the movie, I would just love that movie so much better. And Frank looked at me like I was off my nut. And he goes, are you kidding me? He goes, that score is it's a great score. You're smoking something, and it's something like that. But it made me think, because here was someone I respect very much, going, you think you're being hip and cool, but you're completely wrong. and it made me stop and look and listen. And so since then, I've really embraced it, and now it's like one of my favorite scores.
Thanks to Frank. Here's a great question for you. How do you, well, it may not be a great question, people listening, that's a stupid question, Tom, but I think it's a great question. How do you find some of these out-of-print stuff? I mean, where are your resources to go get some of these really cool things?
You look.
Like eBay, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. I spent two nights trying to score this Jerry Fielding CD. Mm-hmm. Jerry Fielding did a lot of westerns. He did the Magnificent Seven, and I'm sorry, not the Magnificent Seven, the Wild Bunch. And he also did the score for the Outlaw Josie Wales. And as anyone knows that the Clint Eastwood stuff. Clint Eastwood is like one of my icons, and the score for Josie Wales is one of my favorite. I have it on album. Someone actually gave me the album once,
really?
And gave me a tape of a recording of the album. Now, when this person gave me the album, I couldn't play it because I no longer had a turntable.
But for those of you under the age of 30, a turntable is this thing you'd play records on.
Yeah, it has a little needle.
Yeah, a little needle. I think Edison had one.
Yeah, I think, yeah, yeah. But I couldn't play this thing, but I took the record anyway because it's extremely collectible, and B, it had alternate art on it from the movie poster, a movie poster that is classic and is one of my favorites. And this has the Clint on the horse jumping, you know, over something, and it's just brilliant. I had to have it. Now, I still don't have it on CD, and it's way out of print. Mm. And so Jerry Fielding has this collection of his work. And it's got stuff off some other things, too, but it's got the entire score from Josie Wales on it. Well, the price for this one CD got up to over $200.
Wow.
And I know a lot of you are sitting there going, $200 for a CD, Tim, you must be mad. But trust me, I've been after this thing for 18 years, and I still haven't gotten hold of a copy. So, you know, I was bidding on it, and I lost at the last second because I'm no genius at eBay, and someone outbid me by 10 cents and took it from me.
Turns out it was Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. Well, you know, later, I actually, on Screen Archives website, there was a copy for sale. And it was $160.
Well, there you go. You saved money.
And no, I didn't jump on it.
Oh.
I was like not sure I wanted to spend $160 on it. So this is how collecting works,
this
right?
This is a sad story, then.
So it still is beyond my reach. But what was the question, Tom? How did I get on that?
How do you get some of the more obscure things? Right, is there an outlet? Is there an online thing? Because truly, I mean, I'd love to have this friend of yours on. I mean, it'd be a great way to talk to somebody.
Oh, it'd be great.
Because I'm serious. I'm thinking, why not digitize this stuff? And I'd buy it for $9.99.
Well, you know, we almost should have a dialogue with Ed because, unfortunately, Film Archives is not exactly on the pulse of what happens with the internet and how things work. And so,
make it available.
As a result, it's very difficult for. I mean, I actually went, you know, because of my experience being on their website, they were going to revamp it, and I gave Ed a bunch of suggestions, and he took it to the people that the powers that be, and they embraced every suggestion I gave him. It was only a few, but they started putting those things into practice. You can listen to samples, and you can. I was like, I think my main one was, okay, I want to buy this soundtrack, and so you click on it, and you go to that page, and here's the soundtrack, and here's three paragraphs, okay. Now, it's not liner notes. It's not history about the album. It doesn't talk about what the album's about. Mm. It talks about the movie. Papillon is a movie about,
they cut and paste from IMDb.
It's a true story or supposedly a true story based on the life of whatever his name was. Yeah. Played by Steve McQueen. And so it gives you, it's like a breakdown of the movie. And I'm like, you know what? That is ludicrous. You know, we already know what the movie is.
Yeah.
And we want the soundtrack. You know, this is Jerry Goldsmith's soundtrack. I want to know more about that. You know, tell me a little something.
And give me a one sentence recap of the film, but then give me a couple of paragraphs.
Let me know what this is.
Yeah,
and that's something they're starting to incorporate too. But that's what you have to do. You just you have to do a little research online to try to find your goodies. I mean, before internet, good luck finding stuff.
You probably had to call around to rare record shops and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, you really had to hunt and peck. But actually, that was the heyday of and the fun of collecting.
Before the internet. It's become too easy now. Kids these days, they don't understand.
It's become easy, but it's still a challenge. I mean, the internet doesn't ruin it at all, actually.
Well, it helps you get there, but now it helps everybody get there.
Now
you're up against millions of people.
If you're that kind of snob where you're like, well, I liked it until it got popular.
Yeah.
Then that can be kind of have an ill effect, but no. So, it's very simple. You know, you can find the stuff. You just got to do a little research. Simple as that.
So you're into the 60s and 70s stuff right now. You're talking about Roy Budd. What's up with him? What drives you with Roy Budd?
Roy Budd. Well, he's like you've heard Roy Budd, even if you don't think you have. He did the score for I guess what he's most famous for is the score for Get Carter, the 1971 Michael Caine movie.
Hmm.
That's been kind of ripped off and used 1,000 times in different movies. It's like, I think I was watching Snatch the other day, and there's this piece of music in there that's, it's Get Carter. You know? It's like the Italian Job rips off Get Carter.
Yeah.
And I don't mean the original Italian Job, I mean the recent one. He's just one of those guys who has a certain style in his music, and it was a benchmark. I mean, it kind of defined a generation. It defined a certain kind of a film. Get Carter was one of those, you know, like the, what would you call it? A kind of a British mafia type stuff, you know, the early 70s.
And, it's a British Shaft.
Yeah. I mean, Get Carter, well, you know, and I want to name some of those, but like other films of that generation, you know, like, and it's another Michael Caine film, is The Ipcress File.
Yeah.
And it's got this great jazz kind of score by John Barry. And John Barry is a celebrated Academy Award winning, you know, incredible composer who many probably know. But, you know, like, just, if in case you don't know him, he did a ton of James Bond movies.
Nah.
And his was the stuff that everybody remembers. And I'm not talking about that dung, da dung, dung, you know, whatever. I'm talking about just the great themes, the strings, the stuff you really remember. I mean, when you hear it, you go, oh, God, I love that.
Right.
And, you know, he did like Out of Africa. I think he won an Academy Award for Out of Africa. He did Somewhere in Time.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, he's a classicist. Yeah. I mean, he's John Barry, so great. And then he also scored, which is a really wonderful score, is Dances with Wolves.
Oh, yeah.
And but the Ipcress file is just, wow, is it classically awesome. I mean, it's just so cool. But it's that same kind of like that what Roy Budd was doing. And I'm not saying that it was derivative or he was stealing. I mean, that was just kind of what people were writing at the time. It's very much like everyone's, you know, kind of doing that Hans Zimmer, James Horner thing today.
Yeah. Yeah, it's whatever's hot now at the time.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, and actually now it's like Brian, what the hell's his name? Brian Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ever since he did Children of Dune score, people like drop their panties and, you know, it's like now he does everything. But, you know, for a long time, it was, you know, Jerry Goldsmith, one of my favorites. I mean, I used to be John Williams, still, you know, always be John Williams. But, Goldsmith, just if I had to pick a favorite composer, it'd probably be Jerry Goldsmith. But, you know, you got your Ennio Morricone, you know, I have lots of favorites. Yeah, I mean, Ennio Morricone, he reinvents himself about every 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, and you listen to one of the Spaghetti Western scores. And you're like, oh, this is so good. And then you listen to the score for The Mission, and it's like angels came to earth through Ennio Morricone, or Morricone, or however you say his name.
Well, it goes back to saying, why isn't this stuff more widely available? Because this is essentially American classical music. I mean,
sure.
This is our classical music, are these amazing scores.
Yeah.
So it's too bad that they're not more famous than they are.
Well,
so.
It was kind of an interesting thing for me because, well, I always drew.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like...
Are you an artist? Wow.
Well, scores became that thing that, like, when I work, I listen to film scores.
I was going
to
say, that's my next big question for you, is how much you influenced by that as you listen? Do you listen to music hugely, when you work?
Hugely. I mean, it kind of guides you. You know, when you get in a zone as an artist, whether you're a musician or a, you know, whatever,
right?
An illustrator, it kind of guides your hand.
You pretty much always work with music at some point, or?
Yeah, I either work to music or I work to, you know, have a movie on in the background, you know?
Do you have to have it themed? It's kind of funny. When I,
no.
As a cartoonist, if I'm trying to be funny and I have like on this big death score or something, I'm listening to The Thing by John Carpenter, I can't be funny. I need something upbeat.
That's by Ennio Morricone.
Do you need, if you're working on, you're doing, you know, Bad Planet and you've got all this death and dismemberment going on and you've got on something happy and fun in the background, does that affect you as an artist or do you have to turn that off and put on something a little more somber?
Not anymore. I used to be kind of like mood directed mm-hmm. on music while I worked, but you know, I was sitting here the other day working on a cover, and the cover had nothing to do with anything, you know, like happy and fun. I'd say happy and fun, but I was listening to the Beatles.
Yeah,
you know, I made this.
Well, so did Charles Manson.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I totally was listening to the Beatles.
That's kind of great. Yeah. While drawing a decapitated head, I want to hold your hand.
Well, I have like kind of this mixed thing that I call a day in my life. And it's just like my favorite, you know, like, and it's like not the stuff that I normally would listen to. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, normally I'd listen to some Monster Magnet or some Tool or, you know, some classic Sabbath or, you know.
Or like, some Von Frickle like we have at our opening.
Yeah, Von Frickle. We'll get to Von Frickle
in a second.
Yeah, those guys are awesome. Yeah. But no, I mean, I, this is just like kind of like stuff that I'm just reintroducing myself to or, mm-hmm. or stuff that, that I never owned, always loved, like, you know, like Neil Young's Cinnamon Girl, you know, it's like, yeah. I just want to listen to that song. I want it to last for about an hour, but it can't because it's just like a 4-minute song. So it's stuff like that. So, I mean, I get into that stuff too. I get into all kinds of music, but scores are just, you know, that's the true passion.
Cool. Because I often listen to scores when I'm drawing or writing, especially if I'm writing, I need something in the background. And I find if I'm writing something serious, I want some serious music. If I'm writing something funny, I need something funny.
No, I think definitely the work dictates kind of what you listen to.
And I do some film editing too, and I always edit to music, even if there's no music in the scene.
That's cool.
I mean, that's one of those things where a lot of editors, I've read various people, guys who do, like the guy who works with Scorsese, Walter Murch, does a lot of that. He just basically puts a soundtrack that he thinks works with the rhythm.
Oh, you mean as a sound sound designer.
As a sound designer, and then he pulls it out, and but he's editing
or
to
a music
the rhythm.
Supervisor.
Yeah, so that visually you have a rhythm that matches this particular thing.
Oh, right. Well, Walter Murch is one of my heroes.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He was the sound designer on THX 1138, as a matter of fact.
He did he wrote a book called In the Blink of an Eye, which is like the best book you'll ever read on film editing.
I'm learning stuff on the show too.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, seriously, you wouldn't think a book about film editing would be any good, but trust me, this book is really, really interesting about digital editing and just how editing works. Very, very cool. In the Blink of an Eye, go get it.
Walter Murch was one of the original members of American Zoetrope with
Coppola,
obviously. Yeah. Coppola and hey, who else was in American Zoetrope? No, it was a bunch of USC film school guys and then another faction of dudes. And you know, I'm sure a lot of people already know this, but, you know, there's a lot of great names came out of that. Lucas and I mean, just great. Walter Murch is someone I've always respected heavily. And,
he's an artist. Okay.
I think, I want to say... God damn it! I can't remember his name.
We are live.
It's usually on the tip of my tongue because he's one of my favorites, and he just hasn't, you know, he hasn't done anything in a while. But he directed Conan the Barbarian. Come on, help me out, Tom.
Borman?
John Borman? No,
not John Borman.
Borman's an English guy. He was not a part of American Zoetrope.
Conan.
I'm gonna feel like a nitwit when we get to this because John
Milius. Milius.
John Milius.
You found it just before I got there. Jay, well,
I turned my head
he
away.
Did. He found it before I got there.
John Milius is another one.
But I knew there was a John. I don't know why.
He started as a screenwriter, and screenwriter, you know, writing got him the directing ticket.
Right.
I mean, one of my favorite films is The Wind and the Lion, with one of my favorite scores by Jerry Goldsmith.
There you go. Back to scores. Well done.
Well, see, movies and scores, to me, it's synonymous. A lot of my favorite films are a lot of my favorite scores.
Okay, so I'm putting you on the spot here. Red Sky Diary, which is hugely important to you.
Yes.
Who, in all of history, doesn't matter if they're alive or dead, who would you score it?
Ooh.
Who would you have scored?
See, that's tough because I kind of evolve on that all the time. Initially, I wanted to use Elliot Goldenthal, who scored Alien 3, which I think is a incredible score. Whether you like the movie or not, the score is amazing. Mm-hmm. He scored Titus, and the movie that his wife, Julie Taymor, directed.
Oh, I didn't know they're married.
Yeah.
Titus is a good film. It's got a couple images I still can't get out of my head.
That movie is sheer brilliance.
It is.
And if you have not seen Titus starring Anthony Hopkins. Yeah.
Seriously, there are two or three images from that film that I can't get out of my head.
Get thyself to a nunnery if you need.
Get thyself to a Blockbuster.
That's right. Get thyself to a Hollywood Video, pal.
Physician, rent thyself.
And he did Frida, but he also did Interview with a Vampire, Michael Collins.
Wow, that's great stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he's brilliant. And but then I wanted something kind of more organic, I think. And I'm a big fan of Joseph I'm gonna screw this up. LaDuca? DeLuca? No, it's LaDuca. Joseph LaDuca did the score for... I wasn't really aware of him before because he kind of came from TV and he did Xena Warrior. He did Xena
Wow, two shows in a row where we've mentioned Xena Warrior.
What was the other one? Kevin Zorba.
Hercules.
Yeah, Hercules. Mm-hmm. He did the music for that stuff and I was like, I could have cared less about him before because I hadn't watched those shows. But
yeah, but you know, that's really underrated though. I mean, imagine putting out a score every week.
Well, they reuse a lot of stuff, too.
Yeah, but still, I mean, there's a ton of work every week.
I actually have Xena soundtracks.
There you go.
See? I got into Joseph
LaDuca. I think that's really underrated. Television score work is tough. I mean, there's a ton of work, and it's got to be done fast.
There's some really, really good stuff on there, too. Yeah, cool. But the reason I got into this guy was he did the score for Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Oh, yeah.
And I just absolutely love that score. And
it was a beautiful score.
I'd love to have him do it, but they're, you know... When you get right down to it, I don't know who it's going to be. You know, I know who it's not going to be. Mm-hmm. It's almost a better. That's an easier question to answer for me.
Well, it's not going to be me. I know that much. I play a little guitar, but that's about it.
So. I know that if I can get Red Sky Diary off the ground, and if I'm attached to it in any way, I'm going to dictate who does that score. No one's taking that out of my hands.
Well, that's obviously something very important to you, and it's also at what point. You know, I mean, people vary on this. At what point would you want to involve a musician? And it was after the thing has been edited or while things are being filmed? Do you want somebody to, like, really be involved early on? Or do you want them to have the finished product to then sort of digest?
Generally, you wouldn't have the luxury of having them around all the time. But I would like to bring someone in during pre-production just to see stuff and get a taste and a feel.
Start getting some ideas.
So I can start hearing some stuff, whether it's just, you know, on a keyboard and just recorded with a 4-track.
Right.
Or... You know, whatever, but then I'd like to bring him in periodically, and then I'd also want him working on parts of the score while we're shooting, you know, if possible. But the you know, how everyone else does it is you edit the film together and then you send the rough cut over to this guy so he can cue it correctly.
Right.
But then you have cases like where Ennio Morricone knew he was going to work on Once Upon a Time in the West. He'd already done The Man with the Harmonica, gave it to Sergio Leone, and Leone was like, oh, well, I know exactly where I'm going to put this, you know? Right. And I mean, I'm sure there was more to that than what I just recounted, but... That's, you know, it works both ways.
Well, this film you're going to be working on, I don't know how much we can and can't talk about it, but you're about to go work with Thomas Jane on his film. We can talk a little bit about that. How does he work with, is this his first directorial?
This is his first directorial, but...
Has he talked about music at all?
We've talked about music in depth when it comes to this film. This film's going to be a little bit different. It's going to have an underscore in it. So
what's the name of this film? Let's go back to it.
It's called Dark Country.
Okay.
And Dark Country will have more of an underscore. It's not going to be a film where the music, you ride the music.
Yeah.
And it's going to be more of a, and it's going to be a lot of sound design in it, where we're using soundscapes and sound textures. It's a horror film, but it's not a slasher film. It's a gothic kind of... God, what's a good way to put it? I should go to my website. I've written about it. I put a lot of thought into it when I did. I just can't remember anything I wrote.
Once it's down on paper, I'm gone, baby.
Yeah. But
Edgar Allan Poe sort of Victorian, well, sort of gothic.
No, it's a current. But it won't be urban either. It's soundscape. So you know, like what I'm trying to turn Tom onto, or what I have turned him onto, is Wendy Carlos, who scored The Shining and also Clockwork Orange.
Oh wow.
And
that's a pedigree.
So it's very different, you know. This movie is going to have a completely different vibe from anything, you know, that you've seen in the last 10 years. And you know, I was even looking at Biosphere for this score because luckily I say I am looking for Biosphere because I do. I'm a direct conduit to Tom and he knows I know what I'm talking about. So I mean, it's a really kind of interesting situation where this guy who does comic book covers, but has always secretly wanted to be a filmmaker, I'm getting a shot at it, you know, in a way. I'm definitely affecting and have had my effect on where Dark Country has gone. So it's really cool. And so Biosphere, to get back to that for a second, is they did a really, really interesting kind of very, I want to say, morose score for the original version of Insomnia with Stellan Skarsgård.
It's the Pauly Shore movie, Biosphere.
How'd you like a smack in the chops, pal? How dare you?
Sorry.
Hey, let me ask you this question. You know, we talked about this a little bit, and I don't want to bore people too much on the same subject for too long here. We're already 37 minutes in.
Hey, that's what the show's about. It's music.
but what, I know that you like musical scores too. What are some of your favorites?
Well, like I said, I mean, I definitely lean towards the ones I've bought are probably adventure films. I really enjoyed it. I thought the work that Howard Shore did with Lord of the Rings was amazing.
You know, he really transcended himself on that too, because prior to Lord of the Rings, Howard Shore was mostly known for scoring David Cronenberg's movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And all those movies are, you know, a lot of them have very depressing themes in them, from Crash to... Scanners to, well, I don't know if he scored Scanners. I can't remember.
Well, he was a good choice then, because I think a lot of Lord of the Rings is pretty melancholy. I mean, it's about the ending of an age. It's about
I'm talking
the
about
the elves are leaving, so all their music has a real melancholy thing going
on. I'm really curious how Peter Jackson chose him based off of the work that he'd done before. I mean, he scored Silence of the Lambs, another morose, you know, like kind of. The Lord of the Rings score is so much more.
Yeah.
I mean, it is so much more that. I think when I found out Howard Shore was scoring, I was like, why? You know? I mean, because yeah. I didn't know any better. And when I got the experience of that movie's music, it blew me away.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I had no idea Howard Shore had that in him. And now it's like, wow. You
know? Yeah, I have the CDs. I pop them in every now and then, or I listen to it on my my iTunes. And it's inspiring stuff. And it's also really deep and... It really allowed him to do many, many different things because there's so many different cultures and so many different elements of the film that, you know, you can have the writers of Rohan have that sort of Celtic thing going on, but then you've got the orcs with the heavy, you know, the great chanting music. And I thought it was one of my favorite recent scores.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Every one of them, all three of them. And there's a, I don't know if there's an expanded score for the first and third one, but I just recently got an expanded score for two, and it's like, it's almost 2.5 hours of music.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, you got to think about the amount of work that goes into
there. It's just incredible.
Stints. Yeah.
Well, you know, he was working with probably, you know, like on a score like Lord of the Rings, working with 150 musicians as opposed to, you know, 25 or 50, you know, in the other work that he did. I wish I knew more of the technical stuff and could actually be accurate with the stuff, but I think I'm in the ballpark.
137 and a half is what it was. The other ones, I mean, you were talking about the sort of cool 60s and 70s thing. I thought one of the better recent ones, too, I loved it when John Williams did Catch Me If You Can, because it had that sort of throwback coolness. I mean, it feels like
a 60s movie.
Yeah, it's like he stepped away from all the big stuff and just went really simple with like a six, a little six chord, you know, jazz chord thing going on.
It feels really like nice. a wonderful...
Even the opening credits were all that 60s sort of Saul Bass-looking animation.
Yeah, it felt really like an cool Audrey Hepburn movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Or like
Charade
or Hitchcock movie.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, Stanley Kramer. It felt like Charade. Yeah.
It had that vibe. Totally and I love that he can do that. I mean, he's the god of film now, of course, and we all know that. But I think he proves it over and over again. I mean, even the Harry Potter stuff is great for Harry Potter.
Azkaban might be one of my favorite scores ever.
Exactly. It's great stuff. I mean, it's one of the things where you almost take him for granted now, but then when you individually listen to some of these films, like Catch Me If You Can, it's totally different than anything else he's done.
I was stunned.
Yeah.
Stunned. Did we say we were going to talk about this for almost the whole time? We did, didn't we?
I think so. Yeah.
So we said this is our music
episode. This is our music show. We're here.
So
we're
good. So we're well within our rights to keep on this subject.
Damn straight. Yeah. You can listen to some other podcast if you don't like it.
Well, actually, please don't.
No, don't.
Please listen to us.
No,
we have something to offer you.
Us and Comics Coast to Coast. That's the only two you should listen to.
Well, you know, it's like TV. Just make sure you have your weekly lineup. And make sure we're on the map.
We actually need to get you on Comics Coast to Coast because the guys are really anxious to talk about some comic books.
Yeah,
stuff,
so it sucks. We're going to have to wait a month while we work on
Dark
Country.
Well, actually, we have the ability to have you call in, so maybe we'll do that. So we might do that. I'd love to do that maybe with you and Tom. Have you both call in, and we can do it through Skype, and maybe we can have an interview while you're there on set. That'd be a lot of fun. I'm pretty sure.
For those listening out there. Tom and I have been talking about getting Tom down here or traveling up to Tom's house to set
up. I'm the other Tom.
Yes, Thomas Jane. So we can actually have the microphones, the good sound, and all that kind of thing, and have more of
an on-set thing would be pretty cool because I'd like to, you know, talk to you the first week, the third week, and just see how things are going. And I think it'd be really interesting. So
actually, little updates. That's interesting. That'd be you know what? The Tom would embrace that because then he's promoting his film.
Exactly. There you go.
It makes a lot of good sense.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that. That hopefully will be coming
up soon.
Stay tuned. Speaking of, we have the opening music for the last couple of shows, Von Frickel and a friend of yours. These are very, very cool. I burned the CD. I was listening to it. These guys are great. I mean, one of my first comments to them was like, why are these guys not doing scores? I mean,
Tom hates me because he's really great at trying to rein me in because I will talk about, I'll go off on a tangent for an hour and it'll have little tributaries and then we're like, where'd we start?
Okay, we're back here now.
But, you know, it's like...
I'm the guy with the notepad.
Real quick, I just wanted to say this based on our Catch Me If You Can yakking a few moments ago. You're talking about the Williams score. Man, the opening credits to that movie are awesome.
Yeah, the Saul Bass-like animation thing. Oh, I love that thing. Because I watched that going, oh, I'm in love with this movie already.
It's so incredible.
Yeah. They actually did a takeoff of it on The Simpsons. There was like, Bart and Lisa were chasing Homer and Marge somewhere, and they all of a sudden it becomes Catch Me If You Can with a little da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's hilarious.
God
it's like
bless, a dead Matt Groening.
It was brilliant. And so that I thought that was a great nod. They you know, they saw it. Because that's a whole episode in and of itself is the lost art of the opening credit. You know, I mean,
and Saul Bass was the master.
Yeah, exactly. There are so many cool opening credits from the 60s Vertigo, and 70s. Oh, yeah. Just so many of those things.
Anatomy of a Murder.
Yeah. We could talk about, we could list out our 10 top favorite, you know, credit opening credits, because we're both, I mean, I loved animation. I still love animation. And so
can
whenever
I just say one more?
Go for it.
The Satan Bug. I love that movie. Wow. It's a movie no one's really heard of or seen, because it doesn't have a, I don't even think it has a life on DVD right now. I think it's only available overseas, but you know, it's a movie with a second tier actor, and God, I'm going to go on and on. It's got opening credits by Saul Bass, and it's genius, but it's, you know, John Sturges directed. George Maharis, who was like, you know, he was kind of a I don't want to say fly by night. But he was like
George Maharis. He was in West Side Story, wasn't he?
Yes, and but he was mostly kind of a B movie actor in the 60s. Yeah. He did a lot of TV.
Yeah, yeah. He was in West Side Story.
And he's
yeah.
the kind of guy that would show up in.
It's got Ed Asner. How bad could it?
Oh, it's got Simon Oakland. That's the thing. There you go. I love Simon Oakland. He was a regular on Night Stalker, and he was in a lot of episodes of The Twilight Zone, and on one specific episode of The Outer Limits, and just an actor I just truly get tickled to talk about. He's in The Sand Pebbles, dude.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's okay. I love Simon Oakley.
So, Von Frickle, the opening band, we just wanted to just, you know, point out they've got their MySpace page where, and
yeah, just search for Von Frickle, V-O-N Frickle, with an F,
yeah.
L-E. And
it's very cool stuff.
C-K-L-E. Yeah. Von Frickle is actually the opening music you heard is by a friend of mine, friends of mine, Von Frickle. They're based in Bloomington, Illinois, Normal, Illinois, and from Chicago and all parts, but that's where they are right now. And Chicago. They're a four piece, and they're incredible. And at some point, I'm going to get them. I'm going to find a way to get them employed scoring a film, because they're kind of, I guess you'd have to call them prog rock. They're progressive,
yeah,
rock. You know, they're. Their kind of influences are King Crimson and stuff like that.
But there were several tracks on there that the first thing that struck me was like, oh, this is going to be in a film. You know, I mean, it's just, it's got right. that, it's got real atmosphere to it, and all of a sudden it's got some real melody. It's just, it's great. I mean, it's really, it's evocative, and you're not even got a film with it.
Their stuff is kinetic and avant-garde, and it's any kind of like tab label kind of thing you want to put on it like that. Mm-hmm. It's just really well thought out, very, it's almost like math music in a way. It is. I mean, it's very... very strange like that, but you know, it's they're special to me, and it's weird. You know, I could get on here and I could say, well, I'm just promoting my friend's band, but I'm lucky enough that two of my friends are in major bands. Two of the friends that I grew up with back home. One is Von Frickle, who it's gonna sound really funny when I say this, and suspect, but it's true. They have a huge, huge following in Europe.
I'm big in Japan.
And that's not a David Hasselhoff statement. That's straight up. They are gods there. And cool. Someday everyone else is gonna catch up.
Those wacky Europeans, they have wonderful taste in music.
They have fun. Well, the Swedes are the ones that really kind of grab on this stuff. Yeah, they're metalheads and they're prog rock dudes.
Cool. Who's the other one?
The other one is Ike Riley, the Ike Riley Assassination, which also you can find Ike Riley on MySpace. Listen to that stuff. We're gonna have some of that stuff leading the show off at some point. As soon as I get a hold of Ike and get the rights. but yeah, hopefully, you know, you get a little. I think it's kind of fun because I get a chance to do friends a solid, but I wouldn't do it just to do it. I believe in them. You know, it's think they're great.
If we're gonna pump stuff here, it's gonna be stuff that we believe in.
Yeah, right? it's not gonna be some just.
We're not corporate sponsored yet, so you don't have to kiss anybody.
Yeah, no, and it's not because we can get it for free either. Because we could go anywhere and get music for this thing.
That's right.
This is just cooler, I think.
This week's podcast brought to you by Von Frickle.
There you go.
So we were talking about movie scores and how much a movie score can lift a movie. Can you think of any movies that were destroyed by a bad score, that were really hurt by a bad score? Because I was thinking about this, and suddenly one came to my mind.
That's probably more opinion.
Yeah. Well, of course. That's what we're here for. Because my thought was, as much as I really enjoy the movie on many levels, I thought there were parts of the score of Lady Hawk that were awful. Because you watch it now, and all of a sudden it goes from this like sweeping adventure music to 80s pop. And it's like, you know, it just, all of a sudden you go, what? What is that? You know, guys are walking around with swords and Rutger Hauer's out there, and it's a cool movie. And all of a sudden it's like, you know, this weird synthesizer pop music. I'm like, what's going on with that? You know, who thought that was a good idea? You know?
Yeah, who thought that was a good idea?
And I guess it was the 80s and somebody was,
Richard,
you know, doing crack.
Richard Donner, of all people. I mean, he should exactly. be smarter than that. But, you know, truth be told, you know, it's the Alan Parsons Project, pretty much. If I had my iTunes in front of me, I could really kind of access this. But it's it's actually the dude from Alan Parsons.
I love Alan Parsons.
Score.
Yeah.
And,
they,
and
they
it's true.
Produced Pink Floyd. Those guys, Alan Parsons.
There are synth cues in that that make you cringe.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it does not belong in this period film.
It's a great example of why, I mean, back when George Lucas actually had his brain, you know, the most brilliant thing he ever did was get the London Symphony Orchestra and John Williams. Because,
right.
I mean, it must have cost $1 zillion. And this is an independent film. We have to remember that Star Wars was made for very little money. And, you know, they had all these weird special effects and nobody thought it was going anywhere. And then even George Lucas himself said that when he saw the score, he realized suddenly it was going to be a great film. And so,
right.
You know, then you look at Lady Hawk and you're like, well, that's exactly why you don't do that. You can't, like, do a weird current 80s thing because it's not timeless. It's got to be, you've got to have that
right.
Timeless sort of thing going.
We also have to take into consideration that, you know, the London Symphony Orchestra probably got used on all kinds of films,
mm-hmm.
Or all kinds of films, but they definitely were used.
Right.
And John Williams was still at the beginning of his career then.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like he was, I doubt if he was that expensive. What had he done? The Reavers,
well, but, you know, I mean, Lucas
Cowboys.
At the time is barely out of school, really. I mean,
sure.
So he gets a fairly relatively famous composer and then the London Symphony Orchestra. I mean,
all he had to do was show it to him, right?
Yeah.
Hey, exactly. Look at this. And everyone knew. I mean, dude, I remember when the trailers were playing on TV and the movie wasn't released yet. People were flipping their gourds over Star Wars. And I'm sure it had a similar impact on John Williams deciding to take it.
Yeah. Because there's this great I lived in Astoria, Queens, and there's a museum of the moving images there, and it's a really cool little museum. It's got some great stuff, but they have this one section which I think just totally brings it home, where you can watch any number of clips, as like one from Vertigo and one from Independence Day, and you can choose different music to go underneath a certain scene.
Right.
And you first watch it without music, and then you choose the different
that's
music.
Cool.
And it's really cool because it totally, I mean, obviously, I think anybody who knows a little bit about film realizes how much music adds, but when you really see that, it's amazing what music adds. And then when you get to change it, it's funny what can happen. My favorite one is with the Independence Day. You watch it alone, and it's the big ship comes through the clouds for the first time. It's a very impressive shot and everything like that. And the music is really uplifting. But then they have one, I forget, it's like this super heavy metal song
right. That
works even better than the original. Because it's like, I played it, I was like, oh, that rocks! And I think it's by Rammstein or something like that.
Oh,
it was just this,
that's funny.
And it was just, but it was really powerful to see how, and then there was another one from Twister where the camera's tracking in over the all the grain up to the truck. It's a really cool shot. But then you choose this kind of like twangy country music, and it's like a light comedy music. Hey, isn't that kind of funny? And then there's another
one where
it
becomes a Kubrick movie
exactly.
All of a sudden.
And then there's another one where it sounds like, you know, something really bad is going to happen. And it's amazing the power that music has.
Well, okay. Well, first of all, I'm so not a fan of you know, like rock music or that kind of music in a genre film.
Yeah.
To me, it's just out of place.
You didn't think it worked like in The Matrix or anything like that?
Maybe closed-minded. But no, in The Matrix is...
Because I thought that kind of worked in The Matrix, this sort of heavy... You know,
right. Rah. It depends on the movie, but I'm talking about... Well, you know, you tie in... I guess the way you take everything into consideration, you know. First of all, never mention Independence Day on this radio broadcast again.
Unless it's to deride it horribly.
Nothing against Will Smith and Randy Quaid. And,
that could be a guilty pleasure movie, actually, to be honest with you.
It would have to be.
It's more of a car wreck movie than
in
anything.
In fact, you're so guilty if you love that movie.
I don't love it. It's more like a car wreck movie.
I don't mean you. I mean you as the royal you.
It's like it's on and you can't turn away. I don't know why. it's like Dune.
I know.
Dune is that way for me too. It's like a beautiful mess.
But
you just watch it going.
But Dune to me is still genius because it was cast so well.
It was cast well.
It's got that. Speaking of scores, a score from a rock band, Toto.
That's right.
And it's
almost
used expletives there.
Yeah,
yeah. And Brian Eno and I'm sure I'll get flayed alive because they say I love Dune. But Independence Day is not the same thing.
No, not at
all.
Not at all. A different kind of car.
You have to also understand that it was a huge letdown for me because you know, prior to that movie coming out, everyone was expecting a serious film, not a popcorn movie. Well, at least I was.
Yeah.
And do you even know who did the music for that?
For Independence Day?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
We're going to find out here real quick. And while we find out, I will say that, you know, like Roland Emmerich directed that movie, and I'm a big fan of the Stargate score.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find out if it's by David Arnold, Independence Day, because he did, help me out, people. You know where I'm going. You know what I'm trying to say. David Arnold did Stargate. That's what I'm trying to say.
Is that what you're
so,
trying to say?
So, yeah, I favor, like, you know, if I do a genre movie, I want it to fit the period. I want it to feel like
David Arnold.
It is David Arnold. Cool. Yeah. David Arnold just did an incredible score for the new James Bond movie. And for a long time, no one could see anyone but John Barry doing it. But David Arnold just made his move.
Oh, he did. Christina Royale. And he also did some work for Grindhouse.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, and Hot Fuzz. God, what a great film. I
was not aware of that.
Hot Fuzz is a great film. Sorry.
Hot Fuzz was fun because it was a big thumb of the nose at Michael Bay.
Yeah.
You know, and directors like Michael Bay.
Right.
And I'm sure Michael Bay has his fans out there. One of them. Although I did enjoy The Island. There's a guilty pleasure right there.
There's a guilty pleasure.
I enjoyed The Island because I'm a sucker for science fiction. And not that it's a sci-fi tale, but it's kind of Logan's Run meets THX-1138.
Yeah.
And
it looked great.
And too. Then it's not. Yeah. It's this utopian society with these people. And
great production design on that.
Yeah,
film, I must
say. And Steve Yablonsky's score for that is fantastic, by the way.
So can you think of any film, I went back to my question of that doesn't quite work, scores that you kind of went, oh, just didn't quite
You know,
work.
You named one of the best ones. I would have said Lady Hawk, too.
Yeah.
Lady Hawk, that always bothered me, but...
They should redo a director's cut with the right music.
Well, I also have to say that, man, wouldn't that be cool?
I mean, there you go.
And there's a way they could do it, and here's the way. I have the score to that film.
Mm-hmm.
And in between those cues that do not belong in the movie, there are some beautiful, beautiful cues.
Right.
Beautiful pieces of music.
I think that's what's most baffling about it. There's great music in the movie, and then all of a sudden it becomes this weird pop song, and you're like, whoa, what is that all about? Sort of like when I first saw the new Enterprise with Scott Bakula. And this is weird, like, Celine Dion song in the credits. And I'm like, what the hell is going on with that?
I hated that when it first came out. Yeah. I hated that so much.
I thought the show was okay, but I'm much just going, why are they doing this song?
And someone smacked me in the head with a giant fork. It grew on me.
No, there's a guilt. There's an admission of
it
guilt.
It ended up growing on me, and it wouldn't have had
like a fungus.
But let me back that up with something, okay, bud?
Defend yourself now.
The reason it ended up growing on me is because the show ended up growing on me. The show got better.
Yes, the show was good,
and I embraced the show. Halfway through season two and all of season three, I think they found their legs.
Yeah, and then, of course it was canceled.
Of course it was. It was.
It was a whole other show.
Here's the thing, you know, it took Star Trek: The Next Generation 3 seasons to find their legs.
Oh, totally.
It took Voyager a couple seasons. You know, don't you know that going in?
Yeah, no. And then, well, I don't want to get on this because it'll be a whole nother show. But
it's a whole nother
Firefly
show.
Firefly was the exact same thing. It's like
right.
The guy, you know, he's got a whole track record of making shows that have cult followings that take a little time, and yet you're going to kill it right
now. You
from
know, the I would, I would actually, and I love Serenity, I would trade the movie Serenity for two or three more seasons of Firefly.
Yeah.
I would trade it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, definitely. I don't get it.
If I was still watching new episodes of Firefly today, I my life might be complete. And I'm, boy, I'm really selling myself down the river, aren't I? But that's, you know, it sucks when they take the stuff. But I agree with you completely. I absolutely hated that.
Yeah.
The fact that it grew on me is whatever. It's not my.
It's more about you than anything else.
It's not my favorite song ever. And if I still had my druthers, as some people say, I can't believe I just said it. If I had my way, I would go back and I would never have used it.
Yeah,
but like I said, because I did get to the point with the show that I really loved it, it opened me up. And I'm not saying that was a conscious decision; it just kind of happened over time. You still hate it, and that's fair enough.
I do.
I don't mind being on the other side of that once in a while.
Hey, we have to get on opposite sides every now and then. That makes
that's
good
right.
radio. That's all right. Soon. Well, we have to wrap it up pretty soon here. This was a great discussion about music. I would love to hear people's thoughts on their favorite scores on the forums, because I think that the music is really powerful, and how you were affected by different scores and what you think is good.
Yeah, or what works in tandem. What's right. that great film with that great score? And I'm please, I know everyone's going to say Blade Runner. You know, everyone's going to say Blade Runner. It's my favorite movie, and it's got a that Vangelis score, and yes, you're right. Yeah. That's probably top of the list. Yeah. Star Wars, it's another one.
I could talk about Blade Runner. I was going to almost mention it because it's one of the few synthesizer scores that totally works. You know, a lot of times they do that, and it seems kind of gimmicky, but man, in Blade Runner, it's just the best.
Well, man, okay, so I'm shooting myself in the foot here, Tom, because, you know, I like to think that that period needs to, the instruments need to fit the period. But look at 1492, and because we're still talking about Vangelis here, or Vangelis, if you're Greek, that's how you pronounce it. Vangelis is how I pronounced it forever. Yeah, yeah. We'll get a debate about how to pronounce that. But a Greek friend...
Show number 12.
a Greek friend of mine straightened me out on this. It's pronounced Vangelis.
Vangelis.
So, what'd you say? Vangelis?
Vangelis.
Vangelis.
Like, I would like some gyros with Vangelis sauce.
I would like my cereal with more manganese in it. Baklava. It was, reminds me of Louis Bakalov, another great score.
There
another
we
great
go.
Composer. And by the way, I'm gonna suggest a great Louis Bakalov score to you. And you will know this guy's work because if you are a fan of Kill Bill 1 and 2, you know this guy's music and you still can't figure out why you love it so much. But there's a movie called Django with Franco Nero, and it's if you're into spaghetti westerns, you need to track down this film and find it. And with an incredible score by Louis Bakalov in it, so good. And if you can get past the stupid what they did in the 60s, remember when they're like Cat Ballou, I think, kind of did a send up of it. But you remember when movies had to have their theme songs?
Yeah.
Like, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Why does our Western need a pop song? Okay. So Django has a classic one with a dude that they hired that sounds just like Elvis. Django. I wish I could sing, and I'm sorry for that. But
turn down your podcast now.
But thankfully, you can listen to that theme song with and without the vocal. But
you were going to say about Vangelis. Shooting yourself in a
1492.
You know,
1492 is well, it's about Christopher Columbus, right?
Right. Right.
And by the way, great movie. And today I was talking about my favorite actors on the forum, and I did list Michael Wincott, who is so cool. He's got the deep scratchy voice. You know, he's got that. God, he's so good. He's. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yes,
Michael Wincott. He plays kind of one of the main heavies in 1492, Mogzica. Who is always at odds with Chris, as I affectionately refer to him as.
But it was just Columbus Day, so it's perfect. Go
but
see
the
it.
Score for if you're into Blade Runner and you're into Vangelis and you haven't done your homework yet, please do yourself a favor and go get the score for 1492. You will not be sorry. It will enrich your life. Every you know what I'm saying.
It will give your car better gas mileage. It's amazing. Just pop it in. It'll be a good thing.
It's better than Stay Hard, okay? It really is. It's better than a topical.
And on that note, we're going to wrap it up here. So this was podcast number 3 of these increasingly untitled Tom and Tim podcast.
Well, you know what we're, I guess this is, real quick, format is a kind of a topic of discussion for us too. And we're not asking you for assistance on that because we're not.
Because what do you know?
But I think that, it'd be nice to do, to touch on the soundtracks every week, for 5 minutes at the very least.
Yeah.
We want to keep the show moving.
I don't think we can do anything for just 5 minutes.
Well, right now, format's kind of out the window because we're kind of just exploring. Yeah. But as we move on, we're going to have a little bit more of an idea what we're doing. And I think our first show is 90 minutes, and now we're trying to keep them around an hour.
Trying to keep them about an hour, yeah.
Yeah. So, and also let us know what you think. If you want to listen to us ramble on for 90 minutes, we'd be happy to do a kind of an extended show once in a while. But,
and
we need feedback from you guys.
Definitely any questions you have, we can get them straight to Tim. It'll be great. So, yeah, and we'll talk about pretty much anything.
Just drop them on the forum, man. That's the easiest way.
All I know is go Arizona Diamondbacks. That's all I know. So.
Cool.
By the way, I think it was on the first show I predicted that the Packers were going to beat the San Diego Chargers, and they did.
So, that was a bold prediction, friend.
And I made it come true.
That was a
bold prediction.
It was a silly one, but it worked. So. I was so happy for you.
It was a good week.
Even though I live in San Diego, it's like familiarity breeds contempt.
That's right.
I am not a Chargers fan.
No, you got to stick with your home team.
Right? Yeah.
Pittsburgh Steelers looking good. Third best team in the AFC.
Bounce back after that debacle in Arizona.
That's right.
We live, we learn. Hey, wait. We're 80%.
That's right. We don't know when this is. This is a timeless.
That podcast. Was weeks ago.
When was that? I don't
that
remember.
Was weeks ago.
Hasn't the Super Bowl already happened?
We're know. Just. What are we getting ready to play? Denver at home. At Denver. That's right. Okay.
Well, that wraps up for
sorry.
Our podcast.
It's like the David Letterman show. Yeah. Right? Just, we tape in the afternoon, we play it at night, and we try to fool you.
That's right. Yes. The weather outside is it's warm right now because it's sunny. No. Anyway, that's podcast number 3 from Tim and Tom, so we'll tune in again real soon. Hopefully, I would like to think we're going to have a couple of on-set interviews with Thomas Jane. That's the plan, at least. We don't know if that's going to happen, but I think that would be really, really cool, so we'll see how it goes on the film set.
And
so
I'll try to make this my last time for feeling good, looking good, San Diego. Or looking good, feeling good, San Diego.
I didn't get a chance to talk. I was going to, guilty pleasure, I was going to say, do you remember the movie The Sword and the Sorcerer?
Oh, dude.
I love that film.
Dude, Lee Horsley.
Oh, Lee Horsley.
All right, here's
some
a
great
game.
Moments in that
here's
film.
A game. You name a movie and I'll name you 5 people in it.
5
You think
people?
I can name 5 people from Sword and the Sorcerer?
Jeez, I'd be stunned.
How about 8 people from Sword and the Sorcerer?
8 people?
Let me see how far I can stretch.
Give me a break. I know 2.
We got and Lee Horsley.
Like them. Yeah.
We got Richard Mull.
Yeah.
We got Pamela. No, God bless it. She was on some show. I'm going to forget the girl's name. We have Richard Lynch.
Like a weird savant with these people's names.
We have Richard Brecht. We have... God, I probably went too far on this.
I was
going
to say 8, man. You jumped. I thought you were going to go from 5 to 3.
Yeah, I probably went too far on this because I can't remember the girl's name, and that's slowing me up now.
Yeah.
Simon McCorkindale.
Yes.
George Maharis, who
George
I talked
Maharis,
about
that's right. He was in there.
What are we at right now? 5,
I
6?
I think that's 5.
Robert Tessier.
Yes.
I love Robert Tessier from the Deep, please. I can't believe he got killed.
By the way, people, he's actually doing this. I'm looking at the names. He's actually doing this.
I am staring off into space.
He is. He's not looking. That's 6 names from Sword and Sorcery.
Give me a hint on the girl. Give me your first name.
Kathleen.
Kathleen Beller.
Yes.
And I want to say I can do one more. And I'm trying not to cheat. I really am. I don't know. You know, I think that's it.
That's about it. Well, here's various other names. Anna Bjorn.
Okay.
Drew Regalbuto.
Oh, Jeff Corey's in it.
Jeff Corey.
That's I'm right. sorry. I didn't mean to, like, scare anybody there. Jeff Corey was an acting coach and a great actor. And, you know, he's like the guy that gets Butch Cassidy out of jail at the beginning of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Yeah. And he's in Seconds, a great movie with Rock Hudson that you say, Rock Hudson? No, Seconds is genius. It's directed by John Frankenheimer. But let me see that list again so I can go down and I can count how many I named.
I think you named 6 or 7.
Contest here.
I'm impressed.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
So I named 7. Jeez. Okay. I almost made it to 8.
You're like a weird savant.
Wait. I named another guy who's not on this list.
Well, that doesn't count.
Richard Brecht. Hit more.
More.
See, you're like checking the IMDb out with us, pal.
Yeah.
Peter Brecht.
Peter Brecht. Ah, you were close.
I said Richard Brecht, but it's Peter Brecht. And if you're ever a fan of The Big Valley, as a growing
it's
up,
a big valley.
The wonderful Western from the 70s with Lee Majors.
Barbara Stanwyck,
Lee Majors. Peter Brecht was one of the brothers. Mm-hmm. He was the fiery brother, the black-haired fiery brother. He didn't play Jared, the older, more centered brother.
Yes.
So,
or the bionic brother.
That was the third one. Did not play the bionic brother, though.